You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Sir Peter and the Airplane Thief by Mark Wortman. Why had DeMarco taken such chances, risking the power, prestige, and lifestyle he'd amassed while in Jackson's orbit? Money was almost certainly a factor. By now, DeMarco owned the house in Wellington that has since sold for $800,000. The hangar with his apartment had cost another $800,000 to build. He owed Jackson money, which with interest totaled $650,000. And then there were DeMarco's many other planes. He had partnered with a Hong Kong-based businessman, James Slade, to develop a large aircraft collection. But when Slade ran into financial trouble, DeMarco became sole owner of the fleet. According to an interview DeMarco gave in 2017, he had more than 10 historic aircraft in his possession. The upkeep for such a large collection would require serious means, far beyond DeMarco's TVAL salary, even with his extra earnings from film and airshow work. After Jackson reported the absconded airplanes to New Zealand authorities, other fraudulent activities surfaced. Along with the accusations of stealing the TVAL planes, DeMarco faced charges related to a loan he secured for $162,000 from the Bank of New Zealand by using a World War II vintage P-40 Kitty Hawk as collateral. However, that airplane wasn't his either. Oliver Wolfe came forward to clarify the situation. A German banker and aviation enthusiast, Wolfe told the High Court that he had once counted DeMarco among his closest friends. Then their relationship took a turn. Wolfe testified that DeMarco alerted him that his former partner, Slade, desperate to raise cash due to his business woes, would agree to sell Wolfe the P-40, worth an estimated $1.5 million or more, for just a third of the price. DeMarco then convinced Wolfe to wire him the money to buy it for him. DeMarco, however, chose to keep Wolfe's money and presented the P-40 as his own to the bank. And so it was that on December 5, 2019, after a three-week trial ending in a guilty verdict, DeMarco appeared for sentencing. Over the past 40 years, DeMarco was said to have amassed some 14,000 hours of flying time. Many of those hours were in open cockpits, where the elements certainly took a toll on him. In the airless Wellington courtroom, his cheeks appeared jowly, his eyes puffy, his once flowing dark hair receding, short-cropped, and gray. DeMarco, as mentioned earlier, was given multiple opportunities to participate in this article. Instead, he emailed insults. It appears that Vanity Fair has a severely tarnished image in the U.S. at the moment, and subscribers are leaving in droves these days. In fact, subscriptions are up, and VF.com is booming. Chose to communicate by mailing letters from New Zealand, and ultimately insisted upon the right to review and edit the piece before it went to print, something the magazine never grants its subjects. In a final flourish, he asked to be reimbursed for his expertise if he were to answer a list of questions that had originally been sent to him through his attorney. As a world expert in Great War aircraft, he wrote, I am considered the foremost expert in the construction, flying, and operation of such machines. My hourly rate is $295 per hour for attending to your needs. The initial consulting fee is for 8 hours, but will most probably extend. Please attach your remittance for 8 times $295 with the completed consulting agreement attached. He was careful to add, we do not accept Visa or MasterCard. The correspondence was vintage DeMarco, suggesting not a hint of moderation or contrition after his protracted legal ordeal. There was an inevitability about all this, says one of those who'd known DeMarco during his halcyon days at Old Rhinebeck. Anybody who knew him knew it was going to happen, just not the form it would take. One of the people at Omaka who had tried to warn Jackson about DeMarco sums it up this way. It's not the money, it's the abuse of trust. If you go behind Peter's back and screw him, you better have a bloody good cork. Will, for his part, hasn't heard from DeMarco since the verdict, but he thinks the financial problems with Jackson should have been worked out without going to court. DeMarco, he says, had no chance as an expatriate in a foreign country where they hold all the cards. You got to figure that's the way it's going to go, particularly when you're dealing with opposition from a revered public figure. At DeMarco's sentencing, the High Court judge noted that Jackson called DeMarco's actions the greatest betrayal of his life. The magistrate, however, was also cognizant of DeMarco's situation. Recognizing the hardship that a long internment might place on DeMarco's young family, he had become a father again and, with his girlfriend, was expecting another child. The judge handed down a reduced jail sentence of 2 years and 5 months. Even then, he served far less, being granted parole in late September. Now, while reportedly living with his New Zealand family, DeMarco is facing civil suits from Jackson, Wolf, and others seeking to recover their funds and airplanes. Yes, fantasy is powerful stuff. The ex-TVAL staff member believes that DeMarco seduced Jackson, like so many others before him, with his aviation talents and roguish veneer, as if Jackson were glimpsing another way of life through DeMarco's wayward existence. Pete, he asserts, wanted to be him. Gene was living the life that he would have loved. This, says the insider, is what may have allowed Jackson to excuse many of the pilot's misdeeds. Pete, he says, was willfully blind. TVAL has now stopped all new aircraft production and public air shows, blaming the effects of COVID-19. But the former staffer says the halts are also part of the wider cuts in the Jackson Walsh fantasy empire. Gone are the days when Jackson wanted nothing more than to stand barefoot on a grassy airstrip alongside his fellow Kiwis and look up to see his World War I airplanes flying overhead. For, just as it happens in his movies sometimes, a dark rider had flown in and sent Sir Peter's dreams spinning to earth. Here's a Vanity Fair spotlight, Top Brass, by Brett Martin. Photographs by Miranda Barnes. Styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Musical virtuoso Trombone Shorty, on his new album, The Future of New Orleans, and the bittersweet bliss of being standard-bearer for a city's sound. Opening photo, Blue Note. Troy Andrews, also known as Trombone Shorty, photographed for Vanity Fair in December at Longview House and Gardens in New Orleans. And in the photo, he plays his horn and wears a beautiful blue blazer and pants by Versace, with a contrasting green shirt by Louis Vuitton Men's. Just as you half imagined there would be, there's music seeping from the entryway to Troy Andrews' Buck Jump Studio, just off St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans' Lower Garden District. Big, lush, ten-fingered piano chords swell out under the heavy metal door and onto the sidewalk, a sonic cloud you can almost picture following Andrews, better known as Trombone Shorty, since he was a four-year-old prodigy lugging his oversized namesake instrument through the streets of the Crescent City. When the tones subside, Andrews answers the door apologetically, wearing a navy blue Nike tracksuit and a white T-shirt. He is lean and muscular, and even at rest maintains something of the pugilist bearing he assumes when playing his horn on stage. The snatch of piano, he explains, was something that came to him only a minute earlier, and he just needed to hear it out loud. Does he need some more time to get it down? No, I know the shape already, he says. I might finish it tonight. The recording studio is filled with keyboards and horns, and Andrews seems at home, but restless. Last February, he and his band, Orleans Avenue, worked on their upcoming album, Here, which they had hoped to release in time for the 2020 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. That, of course, was canceled, along with the rest of the band's normally relentless touring schedule. 3.5 weeks into lockdown, Andrews, one of the world's foremost ambassadors of New Orleans music, had already been home for a longer continuous stretch than at any time since graduating from high school and going on tour in Lenny Kravitz's band. Needless to say, it's been weird. He's been living with his mother. She lives with me, he clarifies, then adds, don't tell her I said that. Most mornings, he gets up, does a few push-ups, and heads to the studio. It's like I have a commute, he says, wonderingly. This week, he's found himself waking up at 7 a.m., a time about which he had previously only heard distant rumors, unless it involved catching a flight. Earlier in quarantine, the rapper Juvenile would stop by the studio, and the two worked together on beats. These days, he's mostly alone. He'll play a little trumpet and trombone just to keep his mouth in shape. Sometimes he puts on a pair of headphones, chooses a random new music playlist on Spotify, and plays along with whatever comes up. Hip-hop, country, heavy metal, pop, honing the chops that have made him a prized guest for such unlikely acts as U2, Zac Brown Band, and the Foo Fighters. Occasionally, he'll leave the soundproof inner studio door open, as he did while playing piano this morning, and emerge from these reveries to find puzzled pedestrians outside. All in all, his vibe is somewhere between an athlete keeping in shape during the off-season and Martin Sheen waiting for his mission in Apocalypse Now. I tried to switch it in my mind to, okay, this is a well-deserved break, he says, sounding not quite convinced. But it's strange. I have to figure out how to be normal. That's a word rarely used for Andrews, whose story has such the quality of a fairy tale that it's been the subject of not one, but two children's books. He grew up in Treme, one of the oldest African-American neighborhoods in the United States, and the cradle of New Orleans protean black street music culture. Every block had a musician living on it, Andrew says. Many of them were family, nearly all of them family, in a neighborhood of honorary uncles, aunts, and nephews. Troy's older brother James is a band leader who brought the younger sibling he dubbed Trombone Shorty out to perform on the streets and on tour around the world long before the younger Andrews reached adolescence. He learned by ear and on the slab, brass band speak, for the grueling four-hour-plus street parades called second lines. If James's tuba player didn't show up, well, Troy was a tuba player now, expected to pick up bass lines and harmonies on the move. Even in this music-soaked world, Andrew's gifts were evident. Wynton Marsalis, watching him play alongside James at the storied Little People's Place bar when Andrews was no older than 10, leaned over to a companion and he whispered, "This little man right here can truly play." The trumpeter took enough of an interest to later send Andrews some jazz history books, including a biography of Louis Armstrong. Andrews soon drew the attention of businesswoman and arts patron Susan Scott, who secured him an audition at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, a local arts high school, and allowed him to stay with her part-time at her mansion on Bayou St. John. From then on, Andrews lived in two worlds, one of charts, scales, and theory, the other of instinct, improv, and soul. If his musical lives were sometimes at odds, fellow jazz students at NOCA expressed confusion over his interest in rap and alternative rock, while neighborhood friends razzed him for playing that school stuff. The result was a union of remarkable technical ability and undeniable groove. "I had friends who relied too much on natural ability, which can only take you so far, and I've got friends that became too much technicians and don't know how to shut that stuff off," he says. "My goal from a very young age was to maintain where I came from, but enhance it and learn." As longtime New Orleans food writer Brett Anderson puts it, whatever the it of New Orleans music is, Trombone Shorty was practically built in a laboratory to carry it forward. The point is not strictly academic. In less than 10 years, New Orleans has seen the deaths of music legends Fats Domino, Alan Toussaint, Dr. John, Ellis Marsalis, Art, and Charles Neville, and the great R&B architects Cosimo Matassa and Dave Bartholomew. This is not to mention culinary giants like Paul Prudhomme, Creole chef Leah Chase, and restaurateur Ella Brennan, or more local icons like Uncle Lionel Batiste, bass drum player for the Treme Brass Band, who appeared at his own funeral embalmed and propped up against a street lamp, wearing his signature shades. In a city where local culture and outside consumption have been inextricably entwined since the Louisiana Purchase, this amounts to the loss of an entire generation that invented New Orleans as we know it, and it has pushed Trombone Shorty to the front of the line. Like any reasonable person would, Andrews demurs, pointing out that the streets of New Orleans are still filled with legends older than he is. And certainly there are musicians who have gone on to represent the city while living elsewhere. The Marsalis family, Harry Connick Jr., John Batiste, who was a high school classmate of Andrews and an early member of Orleans Avenue. Few, however, have built Trombone Shorty's mainstream star power while also remaining so rooted at home. And there are plentiful signs that he has taken his position seriously for a long time. For a purveyor of good times, he leads a somewhat monastic life. He neither drinks nor smokes. The second of his two kids' books, The 5 O'Clock Band, tells the story of the pint-sized street musicians he led, playing for tips in the French Quarter while still in grade school. In it, Shorty is late to meet the band because he's practicing too hard and spends the rest of the day stressed out about whether he has what it takes to be a band leader, all of while being gently chided by elders about what it takes to represent his community. It's a little intense. Andrews admits that the 2019 death of Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, felt like a turning point. Even more so, the passing of the torch when he began taking over the final main stage performance slot at Jazz Fest, a position previously held alternately for some 30 years by piano legend Professor Longhair and the Neville Brothers. I was like, this is the top of the city as far as local musicians can get, he says. I thought, here we are, it's go time. From now on, there's no looking back. Andrew's ascent comes at a complicated time for New Orleans, a moment of pronounced anxiety among natives about whether their culture can survive the waves of new, mostly white residents, drawn there, paradoxically, by that very culture, who have arrived in the decade and a half since Hurricane Katrina. As the headline of a 2019 New York Times op-ed by the writer and filmmaker Lawless Eric Ailey put it, gentrification might kill New Orleans before climate change does. In the control room at Buck Jump Studio, there is a row of framed album covers running along the top of one wall that suggest the expanse of Andrew's ambition. Two records from Louis Armstrong, one by Earth, Wind, and Fire, Nirvana's Nevermind, Snoop Doggy Dogg's Doggy Style, Prince's Purple Rain, Michael Jackson's Thriller, and Bad. None, you may notice, what you would call a niche album. Don Was, the president of Blue Note Records, says Andrews once told him his goal was to reach an audience as wide as Jackson's. Andrews is only slightly sheepish about it now. I told him, that's what I see when I pick up my horn, he says. I solo and everything, and that's cool, but I never want to be the jazz guy. Even if we never reach the level of a Michael Jackson, I want to attempt to touch that many people through music. I just wanted to make sure he understood how big my mind is. Next photo, Trombone Shorty sits in a folding chair on a brick terrace, wearing clothing by Dior Men. And he's wearing a turtleneck sweater with a black man's face on the front and olive green creased, very sharply creased pants. And he looks directly into the camera. New Orleans has long had a suspicious, not to say neurotic, relationship to its homegrown heroes achieving such levels of stardom outside city limits. Once a musician leaves New Orleans to play elsewhere, his playing is no longer of interest as New Orleans music, declared the 1958 book Jazz New Orleans, 1885 to 1957, an index to the Negro musicians of New Orleans, thus dismissing, among much else, the lion's share of Louis Armstrong's output. There are those who chafe at Andrews' forays across the spectrum of mainstream music, but Andrews has proven himself a Houdini when it comes to escaping such traps. At the studio, he plays some tracks from his new record, the release of which is still in limbo. Andrews says he specifically set out to loosen the reins while making the record in an attempt to solve the eternal problem of capturing the joy of live New Orleans music on a recording. I said, let's go for the raw energy. Let's play as if we're on stage, he says, a touch poignantly, since it's unclear when, in fact, the band will be able to play in front of people next. The result is a characteristic collection of funk, soul, rock, and R&B that is never too far from the sounds of New Orleans, from Andrew's tuba, which provides bass on one track, to the bounce beats that sit low in the mix, like a distant block party, on others. Those echoes help explain how Andrews, for all his outside success, remains so beloved at home. He's never left. A few years ago, he spent one Sunday playing with Madonna and Macklemore at the Grammys, and the next joining the Rebirth Brass Band on the Slab, walking 4.5 miles in the second line parade of the Treme Sidewalk Steppers Social Aid and Pleasure Club. He remains a presence on the streets of Treme, where he seems to know everybody. When I tell him I swim at the neighborhood rec center there, he says, "Say hey to my man Butt." Butt, whom I know better, a senior lifeguard, theorist Valdery, and who is also flag boy of the Black Feather Mardi Gras Indians tribe, tells me in turn, "Troy doesn't do that fame stuff. He stays who he is. You know why? Because of where he's from." "It is," says Andrews, "a simple proposition. I always wanted to let New Orleans know that I'm not going to have to leave to represent this place," he says. "I want to be the person to make people in New York and L.A. feel like they should be here." The Mayor Leagues, as New York reels from COVID and its fallout, an election bears down on the city that never sleeps, nor produces particularly stellar leaders, by Abigail Tracy. Opening illustration by Andre Carrillo. Which has five former New York mayors, their caricatures, that is, with their hands on the desk, with a flag behind them. On a biting Wednesday afternoon in mid-November, Mayor Bill de Blasio, in a dark gray suit, behind a table, awkwardly small for his gangly 6-foot-5-inch frame, running 5 hours behind schedule, leveled a blow to parents across New York City. After months of keeping COVID largely collared, the city had kissed the 3% test positivity rate, the school closure threshold that the mayor, negotiating with the unions, had set over the summer. Days before the presser, de Blasio's Department of Education had insisted that a couple million parents commit to in-person classes or stick with remote learning through June. Days after it, de Blasio reversed course, sending students back to school. The episode was a cornucopia of everything de Blasio critics love to hate about him: spinelessness, indecision, detachment, tardiness, and it laid bare a sliver of the landscape de Blasio's successor will have to traverse. Just a few months ago, 160 irritated business leaders, including James Gorman and David Solomon, called on City Hall to stanch economic hemorrhage. The NYPD union has all but gone rogue, aggrieved by what it views as a lack of support. Even the mayor's staffers have mutinied. When de Blasio vacates Gracie Mansion in January 2022, he will hand off the keys to a city amid crises that any public official would have a hard time solving, let alone one who creates his own headwinds. Is this its greatest moment of crisis? No, it is not, says Hank Scheinkopf, a political consultant who worked on the Bill Clinton and Michael Bloomberg campaigns. He argues that John Lindsay's 1970s City in Chaos eclipses the current moment. And the city faced a singular crisis after September 11, 2001. Yet the contours of the current problems, tethered to each other and stretched by the ferocity of the pandemic, paired with de Blasio fatigue, have set the stage for an epical mayoral contest. One thing we know for sure is that every mayor is both a reaction to his predecessor and also inherits problems bequeathed to him, says Errol Lewis, the host of NY1's Inside City Hall. Crisis is, in some sense, the stasis of New York City, with a mayoralty, a pendulum swinging in accordance. If there is a constant to New York City politics, it is the constancy of change, Scheinkopf says. There are no great heroes, merely men, not yet a woman, of the moment. Ed Koch cast himself as reformer in response to machine politics and fiscal crisis. David Dinkins was something of a healer, elected to ease the racial tensions fomented under Koch. Rudy Giuliani was tough on crime, ready to clean up. Bloomberg was the businessman tapped to rebuild after 9/11. De Blasio was the progressive who could represent those left behind during Bloomberg's second Gilded Age. Who will lead the city out of its latest quagmire, one that some might say is compounded by the mayor himself? President Lyndon B. Johnson once said, "When the burdens of the presidency seem unusually heavy, I always remind myself it could be worse. I could be a mayor." In prosperous times, mayor of New York City is a gargantuan job, more on the level of running a nation than a municipality, with a purview dwarfing most U.S. states, a budget in the realm of $90 billion, 8.3 million diverse constituents, and the largest police force and education system in the country. Yet most days, the mayor is more akin to ombudsperson for any and all aggrieved parties than one of the more powerful politicians in the country. Whoever gets the job, we might ask, why would you even want the job, which is known traditionally as the second hardest job in America? Ken Friedman, who served as Giuliani's press secretary during the 1993 mayoral race and is now a critic of his former boss, told me, it might now be the hardest job in America. There are approximately 3.75 million registered Democrats and just 569,000 registered Republicans in New York City, so whoever wins the Democratic mayoral primary will likely take the election. Given the scope of the job, you'd think the mayorship would be a springboard to the White House. Yet of two who offered themselves up on the national stage this past cycle, one paid to play, and the other ended up stranded at around 1% in the 2020 Democratic primary polls. Both of them outshined by a former mayor from South Bend, Indiana. A third mayor alum continues to make a spectacle of himself, from a hotel room with Borat to the hospital with COVID. Even on home turf, de Blasio barely registers as a political force, eclipsed by the young stars New York City has forged in other offices. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, newly elected Congressman Jamal Bowman and Mondaire Jones, and New York State Senator Julia Salazar. New York mayoralty is kind of like a very well-dressed man with scuffed shoes, says Scheinkopf. What the Democratic field might lack in luster, it makes up for in breadth. The 2021 election could include New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer, whom one source described to me as not burdened with charisma, but whose bureaucratic career seems to be in pursuit of mayordom. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, Sean Donovan, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and Budget Director under President Barack Obama, former New York City Sanitation Commissioner Catherine Garcia, media CEO Zach Eiskol, an Iraq war vet born to Democratic megadonors and married to a fashion executive, Raymond McGuire, vice chairman of Citigroup, who introduced himself with a slick ad voiced by Spike Lee, former social services nonprofit CEO Diane Morales, former New York City Veterans Services Commissioner Laurie Stutton, former New School professor Maya Wiley, who became something of an MSNBC celebrity during her 2-year stint as an on-air analyst, New York City Council member Carlos Menchaca, and Andrew Yang, the face of universal basic income, who also stalled out in the 2020 presidential primary, but whose relevance has grown from his perch on CNN. One rumored wild card is former Speaker of the New York City Council, Christine Quinn, who lost the 2013 race to de Blasio despite, or maybe thanks to, an endorsement from Bloomberg, and amid headlines about her temper, she once said she's prone to open up the bitch tap and let the water run. Why is it that we have quantity, but it doesn't seem like we have this abundance of quality for a job like the mayor of New York City, says Christina Greer, an associate professor of political science at Fordham University. I think that that also answers our turnout question in many ways. Critics of New York City's closed primary system argue that the mayor of the largest city in America is selected by a small sliver of the constituents they represent. In the 2013 Democratic primary, de Blasio got 40.8% with just 282,344 votes. In the general, fewer than 800,000 people voted for him over Joe Lotta. In 2017, de Blasio won the general with 726,361 votes, or 66.5%, not even 10% of New York City's population. A pretty limp mandate. We've gone back to that one-party state model because of the polarization in national politics, says John Avlon, a former Giuliani speechwriter, now a CNN political analyst. When you don't have a competitive general election, you get the low turnout. You get to a situation where the race is effectively decided in the primary. The system may also explain why, for two decades, a blue city was controlled by two Republicans, Giuliani and term limit defier Bloomberg. Why do Republicans win? The Democratic primary process, in order to get to 40%, pulls you so far to the left that you actually fundamentally aren't electable in an 80% Democratic city, says Stu Lesser, a longtime Bloomberg aide. You end up taking positions that may become vulnerabilities. As Greer puts it, there are a lot of shades of blue in the crayon box. The party in New York City has shifted. A decade ago, you would have said that Jerry Nadler is the most influential progressive force in New York City, the validator that everybody wants, a local politician told me. Today, the endorsement that everybody wants the most, without a doubt, is AOC in a Democratic primary. So that shift, I think, is a notable distinction. We'll know soon enough how far left the field will tack, with the Democratic primary shifted up to June from September. And, says Lewis, people who know how to run for office and win, who know how to put together a campaign, they have a huge advantage this time because we have a compressed schedule. You basically have to create a whole organization. For the first time, New York City is experimenting with ranked choice voting. If no one secures a majority, the lowest vote getter will be cut, rinse and repeat, until a victor is named. That's the X factor, says Lewis. One of the few givens this cycle is that the race will be a referendum on de Blasio. In his 2013 bid, de Blasio pitched himself as a counterweight to Bloomberg. He cobbled together a coalition of voters not unlike that of Dinkins and rode it to Gracie Mansion. Then he delivered early on a series of intoxicating voter promises like universal pre-K, a minimum wage increase for employees, paid sick leave, and a reduction to stop and frisk. But the progressive patina faded fast. His offenses have ranged from trivial gaucheries, indulgent pilgrimages to the Park Slope YMCA, even during the pandemic, and flip-flopping on the Amazon headquarters deal, to severe miscalculations. After a grand jury declined to indict the police officer in the July 2014 death of Eric Garner, de Blasio said he had to teach his biracial son Dante to take special care in any encounter he has with the police. A few weeks later, two police officers were assassinated, and NYPD Union Chief Pat Lynch said there was blood on my hands, implying de Blasio's blood on many hands. At the funeral for one of the officers, hundreds of cops turned their backs on the mayor. Early missteps in the pandemic cast a pall over City Hall, and during the racial justice protest last summer, critics dug in. Now the would-be correctives are lining up. But de Blasio isn't without support. Despite the criticism, limiting polling data suggests that de Blasio maintained decent approval ratings. A poll in October put it at 49% among New Yorkers. As much as he's supposed to be quote-unquote hated, he won two races for mayor and is actually fairly popular. He's just popular in quarters of the city that the media is not inclined to notice, Louis explains. And in particular, I'm talking about Black and Latino and immigrant workers and communities. The reality is, De Blasio is an ideologue in a bureaucrat suit. Ultimately, this is a management job, a local Democratic politician says. Are we demanding big transformative change? Or are we just kind of focused on stabilizing the budget, recovery, back to normalcy? It's not like the fiscal crisis, and it's not like 9/11 in the sense that many parts of the New York City economy are doing just fine, and the social and racial justice issues in many ways are even deepened by the COVID crisis and by the pattern of layoffs and joblessness in families who were hurt, says John Mollenkopf, a professor at the CUNY Graduate Center. To what extent is the current crisis setting aside or displacing the social justice and racial justice issues that de Blasio ran on and won on? De Blasio may be a tall man, but a towering figure he is not. I think a deeper thing that people underestimate about mayors in New York, successful mayors, is that there's an understanding that you need to be tough. The city tends to work best with a tough mayor, Avalon says. Throughout de Blasio's time in office, he has been perennially outflanked by the moment. But, adds Avalon, there are different ways to be tough. And New York always feels a little cataclysmic. It's the nature of the beast. You can't find a 5 or 10 year period where there wasn't some major crisis. There is either an AIDS epidemic, or there's a crack epidemic, or there's a crime epidemic, or there's a terrorist attack, or there's another terrorist attack, Lewis says. The norm. Candidates, step up. I don't mean to diminish anyone, Friedman says, but are they the best and the brightest, or are they the least and the lightest?
Thank you.
Vanity Fair's Women on Women, edited by Radhika Jones with David Friend. 35 years of classic Vanity Fair profiles, essays, and columns by women about women. Vogue called it a celebration of women's voices. Dazzling, said NBC News. Kirkus Reviews said these essays pack a feminist wallop. Available in paperback this fall. From the editors of Vogue, Postcards from Home, Creativity in a Time of Crisis. In the spring of 2020, just as the COVID-19 pandemic was taking hold, Vogue asked designers, photographers, artists, editors, and models, and a few celebrities, to reveal what their lives looked like under lockdown. The result was an extraordinary series of self-created images, interviews, and essays, now brought together in one volume. Postcards from Home marks a moment of profound change and serves as a stunning document of creativity thriving through crisis. By the editors of Vogue, with foreword by Anna Wintour. Published by Rizzoli, New York, and available wherever books are sold. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.